This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
August 2nd at noon and again on Monday, August 4th at 6 p.m. To RSVP, contact Eddie Garcia at 713-526-4000, extension 316, or email volunteer at kpft.org. KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. This is Jack Belinsky.
And I'm Glenn Holt.
And that's it.
Yeah, and I think we have a guest.
Yes, well, we have the new pastor at Grace Lutheran Church, and she's going to be here after we go to News Wrap and come back. And tonight is also, being the fourth Monday of the month, is Queer Music Heritage. So we have a pretty full show, and just in case you're not quite attuned to the hour, which we're still trying to get used to, we're on from 9 to 11 now here on KPFT. Looking in the future, we might be preempted during the conventions, but we'll have to wait and see. Certainly not for Olympics, because I guess because Pacifica is not sending their crew out there.
I don't think KPFT or Pacifica had the millions it took to subscribe
to
the Olympics.
Exactly, and we've got more important things to do to be covering. So all that's coming up, but let's go to News Wrap first from This Way Out.
I'm Lee Moore.
And I'm John Beaupre.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 26, 2008. Two more LGBT groups have been given consultative status by the United Nations Economic and Social Council, or ECOSOC. COC Netherlands and the State Federation of Lesbians, Gays, Transsexuals, and Bisexuals of Spain will now be allowed, as non-governmental organizations or NGOs, to deliver oral and written reports at UN meetings and to organize events there. ECOSOC, consisting of 54 member states of the UN, grants consultative status after reviewing recommendations of its subsidiary body, the NGO Committee, which screens the applications. Among more than 3,000 such groups, only a handful of LGBT organizations have gained consultative status, often after the full ECOSOC overturned negative recommendations from its NGO Committee, which is typically dominated by member countries hostile to LGBT rights. In recent years, ECOSOC has approved Danish, German, and Swedish LGBT organizations for consultative status, along with a group from the Canadian province of Quebec and the European branch of the International Lesbian and Gay Association. The U.S.-based International Wages Due Lesbians and the Australian-based Coalition of Activist Lesbians have each had consultative status at the UN for more than a decade. The NGO committee is scheduled to review several additional applications from LGBT groups at its next two sessions in January and May 2009.
Some 5,000 athletes from across Europe converged on Barcelona this week for the annual Eurogames, which were first held in 1992 in the Dutch capital of The Hague. More than 30,000 tourists were expected to attend the Olympic-style sporting event in the Spanish port city, which is open to competitors of all sexual orientations and gender identities. Organizers say it could boost the local economy by up to 30 million euros, almost 48 million U.S. dollars. The four-day event kicked off on July 24th in colorful opening ceremonies at the Palau Sant Jordi Indoor Sporting Arena, which also hosted events during the 1992 Summer Olympic Games. Athletes are competing in several venues around Barcelona in 28 different sports, including tennis, swimming, track and field, and basketball. But same-gender versions of ballroom dancing are also a competitive sport. Queer conferences and cultural events are also being held in conjunction with the sports competitions.
More than 120,000 people turned out for Vienna's 13th LGBT Pride Parade on July 12th. Organizers called for an end to discrimination in Austria and for marriage equality.
But an attorney for the family of a California gay man who died after being shot by police during an LGBT pride-related boat cruise in San Diego Harbor is planning to file state and federal civil rights lawsuits. Brian Claypool said the suits will accuse San Diego Harbor Police and the two officers involved of excessive force, negligence, and civil rights violations. Harbor Police were alerted by operators of the charter boat late in the evening on July 19th that a man had gone overboard. 37-year-old Stephen Paul Hirschfield of West Hollywood was rescued, but reportedly began fighting with officers. He allegedly grabbed a taser from one officer and hit him in the face, and then, police officials said, Hirschfield attempted to take the officer's handgun. As the two struggled, a second officer shot Hirschfield. He was pronounced dead by paramedics when the police boat docked. But family attorney Claypool said that autopsy results showed no evidence on Hirschfield's body that he had struggled with police prior to being shot and that he was not the aggressor. The way the officers handled the situation, he said, is consistent with individuals who have a bias or prejudice against gay people. A spokesperson for the Harbor Police said the department had no comment because it had not yet seen details of the lawsuit.
A judge ruled this week that 14-year-old Brandon McInerney, who's charged with the hate crime murder in February of 15-year-old fellow student Larry King in an Oxnard, California classroom, will be tried as an adult. He faces 50 years to life in prison. Several classmates have said King would wear feminine attire, sometimes flirting with and angering other boys at the school. He was shot in the head during a morning computer class. More than 20 other students were in the room at the time. McInerney was arrested shortly thereafter. His attorney fought to have the teen tried as a juvenile. A conviction in juvenile court would have allowed him to go free at age 25. A coalition of 27 LGBT rights groups had sided with McInerney's lawyer and called on the district attorney not to prosecute McInerney as an adult. But he will be formally arraigned as an adult on August 7th.
26-year-old physics student Ahmet Yildiz, dubbed Turkey's gay poster boy after he attended an international LGBT event in San Francisco last year, was shot to death late last week as he was leaving a cafe in Istanbul. He tried to escape his attackers in his car, but lost control, crashed at the side of the road, and died shortly afterwards in the hospital. Friends told reporters that he was a victim of Turkey's first gay honor killing. Women have until now been the only known victims of such murders, usually by male relatives, for offending chauvinistic conservative social traditions, so Yildiz's case may be unique. Friends speculate that he was targeted after coming out as a gay man earlier this year. "I never heard Ahmet have a friendly conversation with his parents," one close friend and neighbor told the London Independent newspaper. "They would argue constantly, mostly about where he was, who he was with, and what he was doing," he said. "They wanted him to see a doctor who could cure him and get married." Yildiz reportedly told a prosecutor 5 months ago that he had been receiving death threats, but no action was taken. His boyfriend, who held a German passport, left the country soon after the shooting on the advice of the consulate. Police claimed to be investigating the case. "He could have hidden who he was, but he wanted to live honestly," another friend told the newspaper. "When the death threat started, his boyfriend tried to persuade him to get out of Turkey, but he stayed. He was too brave."
Thousands of LGBT activists from across Australia protested Roman Catholic Pope Benedict XVI's visit to the country this week. He'd been in Australia as part of World Youth Day, a mass gathering of adherents aimed at encouraging them to celebrate their faith. As pilgrims marched from Anzac Parade and Moore Park Road in Sydney on July 20th, thousands of protesters handed out condoms and waved placards along the route with slogans like "Pope, go homo." It was mostly peaceful, although a Catholic man was arrested for allegedly punching one of the protesters. He was later released without charge. New South Wales police officials had originally banned protesters from attending World Youth Day events under the pretense that it was illegal to annoy the pilgrims. The Australian federal court rejected that assertion. Pope Benedict has since returned to Rome.
A U.S. House panel on July 23rd heard from five witnesses in the first ever congressional hearing to consider the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The measure banning open gays and lesbians in the armed forces was adopted early in the Clinton administration. Three of those testifying advocated repeal of the policy, but two others charged that Don't Ask, Don't Tell wasn't strong enough to prevent gays and lesbians from enlisting. Captain Joan E. Dara, a retired naval intelligence officer who served for 29 years, and Staff Sergeant Eric Alva, a retired Marine who lost his leg as the first American injury of the Iraq War, testified about how the policy prevents qualified personnel from serving their country. Retired heterosexual Major General Vance Coleman, an African-American who joined the Army in 1947, 1 year before President Harry Truman desegregated the military, also told the panel that, "I know what it's like to be treated like a second-class citizen." But Elaine Donnelly, president of the Center for Military Readiness, testified with what Washington Post columnist Dana Milbank described as an extraordinary exhibition of rage. She claimed that lesbians would take pictures of other service women while they were showering, warned of forcible sodomy, that gay men would spread HIV positivity through the ranks, and that repealing the policy would allow personnel to cross-dress. A member of the House panel, Democratic Representative Dick Snyder of Arkansas, called her statements just bonkers and dumb. Sergeant Major Brian Jones, a retired Army officer, warned that cramped wartime conditions often require skin-to-skin contact when soldiers must huddle to protect themselves from cold, a situation he argued in which arousal would be disastrous. While those testifying against repeal seem to generate more support in the committee for overturning Don't Ask, Don't Tell, most analysts say there's little chance that a congressional vote will come this year and that President Bush would likely veto a repeal measure if it passed.
And finally, a court in Athens has rejected a lawsuit spearheaded by a male resident of Lesbos demanding that the term lesbian should only be legal to describe those who live on the Greek island. The plaintiffs argued that Lesbos residents held sole claim to the word and that its use in the context of female sexuality disgraced them around the world. The suit also claimed that the name of the national LGBT group Homosexual and Lesbian Community of Greece insults the identity of the people of Lesbos. The island is a popular holiday destination, especially for lesbians, because it was home to the ancient poet Sappho, who passionately wrote about love between women. Several residents testified during the trial, in fact, that the use of the word lesbian had brought recognition to the island and boosted its tourist economy. The ruling not only threw out the lawsuit, the plaintiffs were also ordered to pay court costs. They told reporters, however, that they're considering an appeal.
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 26, 2008. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Lee Moore.
And I'm John Beaupre.
This is Queer Voices. And since this is the fourth Monday of the month, we thought that we would go ahead and play J.D.'s Queer Music Heritage. We have a guest scheduled, actually, to come in around 10 o'clock. So here's Queer Music Heritage for this month, and then our guest to follow.
We stood in the windy city, the gypsy boy and I. We slept on the breeze in the midnight, with a rain dropping tears in our eyes. And who's going to be the one to say it was no good what we done? I dare a man to say I'm too young, for I'm going to try for the sun. We huddled in the derelict building, and when he thought I was asleep, he lay his poor coat around my shoulders and shivered there beside me in a heap. And who's going to be the one to say it was no good what we done? I dare a man to say I'm too young, for I'm going to try for the sun.
We sang and cracked the sky with laughter.
This is J.D. Doyle, and you're listening to Queer Music Heritage, a part of Queer Voices on KPFT. Fans of 60s music may recognize that song as To Try for the Sun, first released by Donovan in 1966. It was not one of his hits, but it contained some gay nuances. Basically, it's the tale of two young, homeless teenagers comforting each other, and how they did that was left up to the listener. I sure didn't miss it when I heard the song in the late 60s. Remember, at that time, there was just not much gay subtext to hear in any music. That version was from a 1982 cassette by Elliot Pilshaw and Lawrence Glamberg, and Elliot is the subject of this show's interview. Elliot Pilshaw has been recording as an out gay musician since his debut release in 1982. He is co-founder of the Flirtations, an original cast member of Tom Wilson Weinberg's 10% Review, and founder of Sons and Lovers, a gay a cappella quintet. And he's an excellent recording artist on his own. You'll hear all about that on this show. When did you first blend your gay identity with your music?
I started coming out around, around 1980. One of the first things I did was I started going to the gay synagogue in Los Angeles, where I was living at the time. That's where I met Lauren Slamberg, the guy that I made the first cassette with, first album, Bending the Rules. And he was a volunteer cantor, like a cantorial soloist at the gay synagogue in L.A. And he and I got to know each other and realized we had a lot in common musically in terms of Jewish music. And he started introducing me to a lot of the lesbian feminist singers of the time. I was already familiar with Holly Near, and then he also would play albums by Chris Williamson, Meg Christian, and Alex Dobkin. We were listening to all that stuff, and I loved it. I loved all of it, and I thought, how come this is only happening in the women's movement? As far as I knew, there was nothing, no parallel in the gay men's world. And I thought, I just resonate to this music so much. And Lauren felt the same way. And so we thought, why don't we start singing songs by these people and also look for other songs that might sort of fit in. And we wanted to be inspirational as gay men the way these women were. It just seemed like there was a big vacuum to fill. I just felt like a calling in a way, like that was what I wanted to do.
So tell me about the first recording, Bending the Rules.
At first, we didn't have any ambition to perform publicly or to do this in any kind of public or professional way. We just got together for fun, and occasionally we'd sing for our friends at little parties or gatherings. And after a few months of doing this, we went to this thing called the California Men's Gathering. It's a weekend retreat, mostly for gay men, but some straight men go too. A friend had asked us to perform at it, and they loved it. And it was a great audience, and they really loved it. And then the response that we got was all these people coming up afterwards saying, you guys ought to be doing this professionally. You should be going out and performing. And Charlie Murphy was there, and he actually invited us to be an opening act for a concert that he would be doing a few months later in L.A. And that was very thrilling. And we started performing at small venues around town, and we did the concert with Charlie, and after that we decided to make a recording. We'd never done anything like this before, but we just kind of figured it out as we went along.
Since people wonder such things, were you two a couple?
Oh, no. Yeah, people did ask that a lot. But no, we weren't. But I think one of the reasons that people asked that, just aside from the normal curiosity, was that when we performed as a duo, we would sing together and we would really relate to each other in a very sweet way. We'd smile at each other. We would really get into enjoying the harmonies we would make. We clearly had a tremendous affection for each other as close friends, and we let that show on stage. And I think that that, unfortunately, is unusual among men. And we realized that that was something that we were very, that was very natural for us, and that people responded to tremendously. They were very moved by it. So I thought, wow, you know, this is something that's so easy to do, and it's something that people want to see so much and see so little of.
Another song you did that wasn't so subtle was Kristen Lem's How Nice.
Right. Not subtle at all. Yeah, I love that song. It's about heterosexual privilege in the sense of how heterosexual relationships are celebrated often so elaborately and with so much fanfare by families and by society, and how gay relationships were invisible and were either received no recognition or received condemnation. And so the double standard, it was about the double standard.
How nice a tender untried feeling is growing in his heart when he sees his lover's glances.
How nice she finds him quite appealing, but holds herself apart, still prefers not to take chances. He finds her name in poetry, she finds him on TV. They cast themselves as famous lovers back through history. But if both of them were women, or if both of them were men, who would be their famous lovers then? How nice! They're starting to go steady. He calls her every day, and they're going out together. How nice! Their parents think they're ready. It will happen anyway. You can't hold them back forever. He's proud of her intelligence. She's proud of his physique. They're proud to be in public at the prom, they're cheek to cheek. But if both of them were women, or if both of them were men, where would they dance together then? How nice!
They're feeling so romantic. They're kissing on the street. They see no one but each other. How nice! No reason to get frantic. It's really pure and sweet. They look like sister and brother. They stand in line for movies and they hold each other tight. Go out with other couples, hand in hand under the lights. But if both of them were women, or if both of them were men, where would they show affection then?
Be married. Their parents were so worried that there wouldn't be a wedding. How nice! Traditions have been carried. Now the family's in a flurry. Oh, it's such a happy ending. With rings and vows and showers, they will certify their love. With presents from the relatives and blessings from above. But if both of them were women, or if both of them were men, who would congratulate them then?
How nice.
How nice. How nice.
Again, that song was How Nice. And it's interesting, at least to me, that it was written by a straight artist, Kristen Lems. I've played her version on this show before. A song I might not have expected you to sing on that album is Holly Near's Something About the Women.
Oh, Why would you not have expected that?
Well, probably a listener back in, this was what, 1982, wouldn't have thought, wouldn't expect a woman's song on a cassette by a man, by two men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They still wouldn't.
Yeah, really, yes.
I know. Well, yeah, well, the reason we did that was because we were so deeply inspired and constantly inspired by Holly Near and people like her, the other women that I mentioned earlier. They were our heroes. They were our role models and our mentors, and we wanted to model ourselves. I mean, I wanted to model myself after them, because I thought what they were doing and what they had figured out how to do through music, in terms of inspiring people to come out of their shell and be themselves, and be themselves not just as gay people, but in every way, be yourself fully. So we sang that as a tribute to the women of the women's movement, make a statement that we were totally supportive of it and connected to it and part of it.
Oh, there's something about the women, something about the women, something about the women in my life. Oh, there's something about the women, something about the women, something about the women in my life. Oh, there's something about the women, the writing of the women, the poetry of the women in my life. Oh, there's something about the women, the singing, the harmony of the women in my life. Oh, there's something about the women.
Something About the Women by Elliot Pilshaw and Lawrence Glamberg. Before I move on, I want to give you a sidebar to tell you about Lawrence Glamberg's music career, which has been extensive. He's appeared on over 50 albums and is noted as a member of the Klezmatics. The music is called klezmer and is a genre a little hard to describe, as it's Jewish music with influences from just about all over. The Klezmatics have released 9 albums over the last 20 years and have won numerous awards. But back to our interview.
After Bending the Rules, you released a solo cassette in 84, which seems like spoke to one of your passions in life, called Native Tongue.
Yeah. That was an album of Israeli songs, all sung in Hebrew. What that came out of was, I guess around when I was a junior in college, I had gone to Israel, like for a year abroad of study. But the main thing that really, really inspired me and I got the most excited by when I was there was the music. I bought records. In those days, people were buying LPs, and I bought records like crazy and listened to the radio all the time. I made that album. It was really a collection of some of my favorite Israeli songs from the late 70s, early 80s period, which is when I was there.
La 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 וסגרירו גשמים כל היתר, אך שבעה ימים הברדים פורחים, ושבעה ימים הכללים זורחים, ושבעה ימים הלבבות פתוחים. וכל קמצוניים עומדים ברחוב, ונושאים חברונם אל האור הטוב, וכל קמצוניים אחים.
la, la, la.
I won't even try to pronounce the title of that track from Elliott's album, Native Tongue. After living in L.A. for a few years, you moved to Boston, where you became quite involved with the production of Tom Wilson Weinberg's 10% Review.
Yeah, it was good timing. I just was there when he was had just written that show and was putting it together. There was a very, very tight-knit community of musicians in Boston. Tom and I became friends, and he was putting the show together, and I got involved in it pretty early on. It was a like a musical review of some songs he had recorded on his own before. I think he wanted to put together a review of his songs sung by different people, and he wanted to have two men and two women singers, and then he was at the piano. So we did the song at the Arlington Free Church in Boston, and it was very well received, and a producer offered to produce a whole summer run of it in Provincetown. So we took it to Provincetown and performed for like 10 weeks. That was a really great experience. It was like performing six nights a week and getting paid for it, which was unusual. And then because Provincetown draws people from all over the country, there were people who saw us from other cities, and then we wound up making connections and getting bookings in other cities. And so the show had an opportunity to tour. Really fun.
I think Tom has told me that you took the show to the West Coast.
Yeah. We did the show in San Francisco for a whole summer, the next summer. And that was at the Valencia Rose, which was a kind of a gay cabaret coffee house. Yeah, I got involved I was in the show, and I also kind of got involved in the production end and was managing the production of that during that summer, as well as performing in it.
I have a copy of, I think, the first recording of 10% Review live in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
That's from 85. And I'd like to ask about a particular song, Before Stonewall.
Oh, yeah. That was a song that Tom wrote that talks about what gay life was like before the Stonewall riot and how people had to live in hiding and secrecy. And there was a lot of references to sort of code words and language that people would use in bars or in other situations where they couldn't be out, where they would say something like, "Do you know Dorothy?" Like, "Are you a friend of Dorothy?" And other types of things that people would say to find out if another person they thought might be gay was. It was commemorating the time when everybody had to be closeted and how difficult it was to be out.
There was a time before demonstrations when the queens and the fairies were shy and fearful. We ran and we hid from the fist and the knife, and we still found each other. The ones in the light. Do you know Dorothy?
Do you have the time?
Have you got a light, dear?
Change for a dime. Do you come here often?
I see what you mean.
I know a tavern where we won't be seen. There was a time before celebration, when all my sisters were ghosts and shadows. Every femme had a butch, every husband a wife, but we still found each other, the ones in the light.
Do you know Dorothy? Do you have the time? Have you got a light, dear? Change for a dime.
From the cast of 10% Review, singing on the track Before Stonewall were Elliot Pilshaw, Gene Gauthier, and Tom Wilson Weinberg. Now it's time to talk about your recording, Feels Like Home. Could you tell me about that album?
Yeah, I did not want to stop working with Lauren, but, you know, we did go separate ways. The idea of being a solo performer was not one of my dreams. I love ensemble work, and that's why I was very drawn to working in 10% Review and later on in the Flirtations. And, you know, I love working with other people, whether as a duo or as a part of a small group. Artistically, there's so much music out there that I love. I'm sort of a song collector in a way, and I just know a lot of songs by a lot of people that may not be all that well known. So I thought it would be great to put together an album of some of my favorite songs that I think have a message that would be a powerful, loving, and inspiring message that I could put out as an openly gay man.
I have to ask, who's on the cover of that album with you?
Oh, yes, everybody wants to know, who's that guy? Ooh, because I'm leaning intimately and affectionately against the back of another man, and you don't see his face. That was my friend John Paul, and he's a graphic designer who is a good friend of mine, and he was the designer for the album cover. Actually, he and the photographer Irene Young came up with this idea that the song is all about relating to people and intimacy and love and relationships. So why not show you relating to somebody? And his face wasn't in it because, it wasn't his album. It was me. But it was. I thought it was a great idea to come up with something where the cover conveyed something about relating to someone instead of just me, you know. Which,
this was kind of early for an album cover to do that. I guess it's still early.
Well, I'll tell you, it was pretty scandalous in my family. But most people, you know, most of my friends and other gay people that I knew, they loved it. They thought it was a beautiful image.
I'd like to hear about you're doing the song Matelot.
Well, that song is by Knowles Howard. Somebody's singing about a sailor that they're in love with who is going off sea for a long time, and how much they miss that person. The sailor's name is Matelot, and they're longing for that person, for that guy. and it was probably meant to be sung by a woman about a man, but I thought it was written by Noel Coward, who is a man, so I thought that it came from him, it came from his heart. It was coming from a man knowing what it's like to love and miss and long for another man who they love. So I loved the song.
Jean-Louis Dominique Pierre Bouchon, true to the breed that bore him, answered the call that held in thrall his father's heart before him. Jean-Louis Dominique sailed away further than love could find him. Yet through the night he heard a light and gentle voice behind him say, Martello, where you go, my heart goes with you. Martello, when you go down to the sea, as you gaze from afar on the evening sky, wherever you may roam, you will remember the light through the wintry night that guides you safely home. Though you find humankind to be frail, our love will not fail, my friend. Our love will not end. Martello, where you go, my thoughts will follow. Martello, when you go down to the sea.
On to the title track, please tell me about the song Feels Like Home.
Feels Like Home was written by John Bacchino, who plays the piano on the whole album really beautifully. I can't say enough about him as a musician and as a songwriter. He's extremely talented. And so this is a song that he wrote. It's one of those genderless love songs. So anybody could sing that song. It's really not about being gay specifically, but I figure any love song sung by me automatically can become a gay song. You know, and a lot of it has to do with what context you put it in. So if I put it in the context of that album, to me it was a gay love song.
I hear your key in the door unlocking, more than wood. The ceiling may not be dry yet, but it feels like home. Yes, we have come from a long way, friends say, wrong way. Still, I only know when you hold me, it feels like home. We don't need a dining room table, so far there's no just fine, as long as I'm with you each night. It seems to me, if you never risk, you never. And since we're in this together, it feels like home. Will do just fine, as long as I'm with you each night. Yes, we have come from a long way, friends say, wrong way.
still. I only know when you hold me, it feels like home. It feels like home. It feels like home.
I just love that. The title track for the album, Feels Like Home. I think next in your musical career is your involvement with the Flirtations. Tell us about that.
That was a really amazing chapter in my life, and it came about in a kind of a funny way. After my involvement with the 10% Review kind of wound down, there was another guy who had been in the 10% Review with me, named John Arterton. And we had performed together in it, some of the productions. The show was over. We wound up back in New York. I was living in New York at that point, and he already lived there. And we had become friends. And we got together to go out for breakfast at a coffee shop in Brooklyn. Just for talking casually over breakfast about the idea of, wouldn't it be great to start some kind of a gay men's political singing group that would go sing at ACT UP rallies and gay pride events and other types of political rallies and things, just to kind of lend support and inspiration. And so I said, well, how about if we start a gay singing group, an a cappella group? And I think he said something like, no, I don't know if it's a good idea. And then the next day he called me up and said, I've been thinking about your idea and I haven't really been able to stop thinking about it. Let's talk about it some more. So he had started to get interested and excited about the concept. So he and I just came up with the idea of this group, and we put out a notice in the gay newspaper in New York and put up some flyers to the Gay Community Center about auditions. And number of people called and came to audition. Among them was Michael Callan. And we had our group very quickly. And then we spent a couple of nights brainstorming about the name and came up with, like, I don't know, a list of like 30 crazy names. And finally, the Flirtations just jumped out as, that's the name. You know, that just felt right. That's how it got started.
There's a lot more to this story, but too much for my radio time constraints. But you can hear it in the internet version of this show. I've got to slip in a song by the Flirtations, and even though Elliott did not record with them, they used his arrangement on the Chris Williamson song, Shooting Star.
Thunder is shaking the roof of my car. I would go through a desert for you. My thoughts are flying to where you are. I would go through a desert for you. Right on the edge of a storm, tonight I'll be with you and warm. Oh, to lie in the circle of your arms, I would go through a desert for you and for me. I would go through a desert for you. Oh, the sky had been falling when I heard your voice calling
me by my name.
My name, calling me by my name. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw you blazing brightly by.
You're such a shooting star.
That's what you are. You're such a shooting star. Oh, yeah, yeah.
You're such a shooting star.
That's what you are. You're such a shooting star. Whoa, whoa.
You're such a shooting star.
Shooting Star from the self-titled debut album, The Flirtations. And that arrangement by Elliott has also been used on the recordings of several women's choruses. And this is a good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. Again, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carver every Friday night, Saturday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude.
In 1990, you appeared on a various artist album, Feeding the Flame, Songs by Men and AIDS. And it wasn't just gay artists, it was straight artists, including many of my favorite folk performers. Could you tell me about your involvement in that?
I guess in some ways there's a parallel between that album and Waltz to Roses, because it was kind of a coming together of gay men and straight men contributing songs and music to help raise money for AIDS research. I was asked to participate by contributing a song to it. My friend George Fulgeniti Shakar, I think my name's hard to pronounce, try his name, but he's a pianist and singer who I knew from Boston, and he and I were old friends, and he was part of the Boston folk scene. He had written a song, I believe he wrote that song that we did, and he asked me if I wanted to sing on it with him, and I said yeah, and we both had been asked to be part of the album, so we decided we would do this duet together, and that would be our contribution.
You must have missed performing, because around 93 you helped form the group Sons and Lovers.
Yes, I did miss it. Leaving the Flirtations was sort of like, for people who like somehow broke up with the love of their life and never got over it. I kind of never got over leaving the Flirtations, because that was sort of the musical love of my life. And it wasn't easy to get back into doing this, but I decided, why don't I just start another gay a cappella group? And I had to grapple with a lot of self-doubt. Are people going to think that this is sort of Flirtations 2, it'll never be as good, and all that stuff. But eventually I put all those sort of negative messages in my mind aside and said, just do it. So I did, and I had the repertoire, and I had the experience, and I knew how to hold auditions and find singers. And it wasn't the Flirtations. It was very different. But it still was a group of gay men singing a cappella music that was really fun, and some of the music was just fun and entertaining, and some of it was political and had an important message, and some of it was very moving and romantic. And that combination is what I really love to do.
How did you name the group?
It's very hard to come up with a good name for a group. It seems like all the good names have already been taken. And actually, one of the other guys in the group, I think it was Bob Stern, suggested that. He was one of the more educated fellows amongst us. And he was very literary, and he sort of came up with this literary reference, Sons and Lovers, the book by D.H. Lawrence. And I haven't read the book, I don't even know what the story of it is, but the name of the group is not about the book. It's just what Bob's idea was, well, we're all sons, and we're all lovers. Because we were all in relationships at that point, and we all were very close to our mothers. So we were all into being sons, and we're all into being lovers. So that seemed like it would be a fun title.
I thought it was really neat that you covered the Chris Williamson song, Waterfall.
Yeah. Well, that's, again, like sort of like the song Something About the Women by Holly Near. Waterfall was, I would say, is probably one of Chris Williamson's signature songs. And it became, I would say, one of the anthems of the women's movement. When Sons and Lovers did Waterfall, we were, you know, wanting to pay tribute to these women composers, lesbian composers, who were inspirational and wanted to celebrate their music. And it's just an incredibly beautiful song in and of itself, and I thought, wow, wouldn't it be great to try to write an a cappella arrangement of that?
Filling up and spilling over, it's an endless waterfall. Filling up and spilling over, over all. Filling up and spilling over, it's an endless waterfall. Filling up and spilling over, over all. Ba ba da, filling up and spilling over.
And you also covered a song by two of my icons, Ramonosky and Phillips.
Yeah. Let's see, we did Emotional Roller Coaster, because I love so many of their songs are just amazing. Well, I knew Ron and Paul very well for years, and Ron and Paul were very sweet, very supportive, and very knowledgeable about music and the music business. But they were very generous with their knowledge and their contacts and their information. And so that song, Emotional Roller Coaster, about the ups and downs of being in a crazy-making relationship with somebody who's constantly giving you double messages. And I guess we've unfortunately probably all been in those relationships at one time or another. So it was one of those songs that has universal appeal.
Life with you's an endless playground.
Ooh, oh.
So many games from which to choose.
Whoa, ooh, oh.
But it don't fill me with childish joy.
Whoa.
It only brings me the blues.
I used to think stability would only make us dull, but your moods are so erratic that I'd welcome such a love. And I don't know how much of this my fragile heart can take. I'm not as strong as you may think, and one day I could break. Because you've got me on an emotional roller coaster. You lift me up, you bring me down, down, down. And all the time my heart is spinning round and round and round. But it still feels better than being alone on the ground.
From the 1994 album Sons and Lovers, that was Emotional Roller Coaster. And the members of the group, in addition to Elliott, were Bob Stern, Ken Brown, John Whitley, and Dean McBride. And John and Dean have gone on to release excellent solo albums, which I encourage my listeners to track down.
You've also done a little bit of backup work on the albums of others, like on Michael Collins' Legacy album on the song We've Had Enough.
Yeah. When Michael Collins was recording that song, he actually asked a number of singers if they would sing backup because he kind of wanted the sound of a big crowd, a big background chorus. And so I was, I guess, among, I don't know, maybe about 15 other people. We all crowded into the studio and recorded that part for that song. And it was such an honor to have been, you know, to work with him and to be on that album, which is such a beautiful, beautiful album and a beautiful, you know, what we have left of Michael. But I also worked with Michael, you know, very closely in the Flirtations during the years that I was there. And when you're working with, you know, five people working together on music, it's very intense and very intimate. You get to know them really well, and you get to know them really well as musicians and interact a lot as musicians. A lot of people know Michael, who know Michael and know of him, know a lot about his political work, which was amazing and in and of itself, and his own, and his solo music and his solo recording, which is just magnificent. But he was also an incredibly funny, zany person and incredibly fun to work with. And, came up with a lot of the comic stuff that the Flirtations did in the early years, which went over so well with the audiences. It was campy and smart and funny and things that only Michael could have thought of.
KPFT, Houston.
In recent years, you've been involved with the Miami Gay Men's Chorus. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. I moved to Miami about 6.5 years ago. And when I moved here, the Miami, at that time it was called the South Beach Gay Men's Chorus, later changed its name to the Miami Gay Men's Chorus. It's just, I had never been involved in gay men's choruses before. I was aware of them, but I wasn't, I sort of tried them out, but I gone to a couple of auditions and things and concerts, and it just didn't feel like my thing. It felt a little bit too, some of the choruses I'd seen felt a little stodgy, you know, in their tuxedos and singing Broadway songs, and it just felt like it wasn't that interesting to me. So I was not drawn to choruses like that. But when I got here, I just thought, well, I'll go check out this group. But I found this group to be different. It was kind of funny and edgy, and they were putting together these full stage productions that were kind of campy and silly and with good music. And Miami doesn't have a gay community center, and it's sometimes hard to find a community here in the ways that you can in some other cities. So the chorus was one of the few places where I felt like I could make some friends and do some singing. And it was nice to do some singing in a group that was already formed, that I, after years of sort of performing groups from scratch myself, I had recently adopted my son, who was a year and a half old, and I was a single adopted parent, and I really had my hands full, so I didn't have the energy or time to start a new singing group. So to join something that already existed was a good thing for me to do, and I have had a lot of fun over the years in that group.
Looking back on it all, is there any question I should have asked you?
No, I think that you asked me great questions, and really covered a lot. I can't really think of anything right now. There is one other thing I did that I guess you wouldn't have known about. But
oh, definitely tell me.
That was something that I liked a lot. It was something I did in Miami a couple years ago. I got together with two other gay guys who were singers, and we put together a cabaret show, which we called Taking a Chance on Love, and it was a musical review of love songs from the 40s, from Broadway, from kind of any love songs that we liked. And we did a combination of duets and solos and trios and performed it in just locally for a couple of weekends. So, but that was another project that I did, and I'd like to do more stuff like that, because I love cabaret style performing and performing with one or two other people in a small intimate venue for an audience that's really listening, and where you can really get into a song and really deliver a song in a way that's entertaining and moving.
I'm down to the last song, but before I get to it, I want to thank you all for listening. And of course, I especially want to thank Elliot Pilshaw for the wonderful interview. He was one of those artists where it took me several years to track him down. I'm so glad I did. As always, you can find out more about his music at my site, www.queermusicheritage.com. And if you have questions or comments about any of the music I've featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. For the last song on this show, I'm going back to Elliot's 1986 album, Feels Like Home. It contains a wonderful song that itself originated in 1977, and a musical written as a response to the bigotry of Anita Bryant. The show is called Joseph McCarthy is Alive and Living in Dade County. The message is no less valid now, and the song is called Who Have You Loved Today?
I know boys fall in love with boys, and some ladies can live without men. Their embraces in places annoy some people, then some people you'll always offend. Well, opinions are cheap as advice, so take none and never think twice. 'Cause when it's all over, what else can we say? But who have you loved today? Now we all seem to argue too much. and it goes without reason or rhyme. Tell me, why can't we try to get in touch with each other when we know we have so little time? When we all have the same guarantee, sweet tomorrows we might never see. And when it's all over, what else can we say? But who have you loved today? A lot of people will quote you the rules and tell you they come from above. But how can another deny his own brother for something as precious as love? Oh, don't try to explain it to me, how we all got to be like we are. I don't need to read the latest decree to tell me that I've come this far. Just as long as love is in sight, I'll assume I am doing it right. And when it's all over, what else can we say? But who have you loved today?
That was J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage, heard as part of Queer Voices on the fourth Monday of every month. And we certainly do appreciate J.D. producing that hour of programming for us every month. J.D. also has the website that he mentioned, www.queermusicheritage.com. And I think J.D. is probably the only person in the world who maintains such an extensive library of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender music, and actually does something with it and puts these programs together. He's also contributes similar material to This Way Out when they do audiophile. And, of course, on his website, he has extended programming. The hour that he produces for us is part of what he does every month, and the larger programs are available on his website each month. And you can go to that website, find out more information about the artists, see pictures of them, and also hear not only this month's program, but programs from other months. This is Queer Voices.
Every week, except for some special weeks when there's some other programming on, but we're mostly here. And Queer Music Heritage is heard the fourth Monday of every month, and it will probably start at 10 o'clock as we move on in time here on that fourth Monday. Otherwise, we also run This Way Out, which is a weekly news program that we get off the satellite. But otherwise, we like to do local programming and stuff that happens here in the community. We have the new, is it Pastor?
Pastor,
and introduce your name because I'll probably mumble it all up.
My name is Laura Gruen.
Okay. And you're new to the Grace Lutheran Church?
Yes, I am.
So tell me about Grace Lutheran, and then we'll talk a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Grace Lutheran is a wonderful little Lutheran church in the Montrose area. They have a very long history of being interested in social justice issues from a faith perspective. Once upon a time, there were members in the congregation very active in civil rights movement. They have for a long time been interested in changing the Lutheran Church around issues of sexual orientation, involved in Lutherans Concerned is the name of the Lutheran group that does that, but also interested in how do we speak for economic justice, working with groups called Appalachian Voices, who work in the Appalachians, setting up dialogues with folks in the Muslim community, talking about racism, talking about consumerism. This is a congregation that I am delighted to have been called to serve.
Well, is this in the Lutheran Church, or is this specifically about Grace Lutheran Church?
I'm speaking about Grace Lutheran Church in Montrose.
And now it's a rather small church?
It is a very small church. Sunday morning at this point is about 25 to 30 people. We're hoping that will change soon.
Okay. And you're right in the heart of Montrose off of Waugh Drive?
On Waugh, yes.
Okay. In fact, that's also an election place.
Certainly.
Yes,
certainly. Some of our listeners may have been there for that reason.
So how did you come to Houston?
Well, I came only for this call to this congregation. I was looking all over the country for what was the right congregation for me to serve as a pastor. This is my first call. I graduated from seminary recently and have been looking for probably about the past year for what's the right congregation on a national search. And this Grace Lutheran, when they saw my paperwork and I saw theirs, we just sort of fell in love with each other.
And I guess you're looking for sort of a struggle. I mean, it's affirming, but yet you want to grow the church.
Absolutely. And I have been aware that my interests in churches have been in city churches, predominantly more liberal city churches that have been working on sexual orientation, working on anti-racism, and in many cases, just because of demographics in our country, city churches have been struggling, and I have been really excited about how do we tell the community what's going on? How do we start? It's an exciting time in urban ministry because people are moving back into cities. How do we start pulling them into our churches? And that's the sort of situation I've been looking for.
And so that contrast, the church that's struggling a little bit, small urban church, compared to some of the mega churches that are here in Texas and in Houston.
It is certainly a contrast. I love being a pastor to people I know. I would not be attracted to a mega church because I have 30 people. They're easy to get to know. I would be happy to get to know 100. But 1,000 or more, I don't think I could have the same depth of relationship that I'm already forming with the people in the congregation of Grace Lutheran Church.
Now, you're openly gay?
Yes. I prefer the word queer, but I am openly queer.
Yes, and we discussed that a little bit as the show is called Queer Voices.
Yes.
Was there a struggle in the church of going to the your religious training and stuff of being queer in the church?
Well, at this point, the Lutheran Church ordains folks who are, in their language, openly homosexual if they agree to be celibate. That is not an agreement that I am in the least bit interested in making. And so, according to Lutheran Church policy, I'm not eligible to be a pastor. There are large numbers of people in the Lutheran Church working on changing that church policy, and it's very much under discussion. It's something that will change in the next, I'd predict, 3 to 5 years, but we'll see what happens. And so there's an organization called Extraordinary Lutheran Ministries, which is working on the exact same process that I would go through official church channels to become a pastor. It's a 5-year process, interviews and essays and psychological tests, as well as my seminary training. And so as opposed to the official church body being the ones who oversaw that, this organization called Extraordinary Lutheran Ministries oversaw my process towards becoming a pastor, rooted in the same process, and maintain a roster of pastors who they have qualified and credentialed, but who have said, we are going to be non-compliant with the Lutheran Church's policy on sexual orientation. So I'm on that roster. Grace Lutheran Church, when they were looking for a pastor, said, we're not going to discriminate based on sexual orientation for which pastor we want. We want to look at the pastors that the formal Lutheran Church provides for us and this roster so that we look at both and choose what is the best pastor for us. They did not set about trying to call a gay pastor. They said, let's look in all places imaginable in a non-discriminatory way and see who's the best pastor. And I have to say, as a pastor, it is an honor to hear your congregation say that, to hear them stand up and say out loud and on the news, this is the reason why this was the absolute best pastor for us. And it has been I think it's a really good fit.
And you are pastor to not just GLBT people, but
absolutely,
it's a church that's open to everybody.
Yes, Grace Lutheran is a very diverse community. There are gay and straight members both, partnered and singled, all age groups, and in fact, even all political persuasions, although our diversity is perhaps a little bit less. One of my dear members will... He kind of came out to me. He self-identified as a Republican redneck, and yet he feels like this is the group of people who accepts him, who he feels he experienced God with, and he has told me that he's happy to have me as his pastor. So it is a very diverse group of people and open to everyone.
That's really interesting. Now, is there within the Lutheran Church, as we hear with some other denominations, that there's a that some of the churches are going to split? Is there any? Is that happening within the Lutheran Church? They're allowing queer people in there in leadership and stuff, but
there's no serious discussion about splitting. There are groups who are, just as we are organizing on our side, there are groups organizing on the other side, and occasionally there's a little bit of noise, but I don't think it's a serious possibility. We'll see what happens. I could be wrong.
And does that go across international borders too? Are there more conservative elements?
There certainly are. We're not organized the way the Anglican Church is quite as centrally on an international level.
Or the Catholic Church.
Or the Catholic Church, right. For that matter. Yeah. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America is the name of my denomination. It is a national church body, national denomination, and all of our decisions are made on a national level. There are other Lutheran denominations in the United States which are much more conservative, who are not having this discussion at all. On an international level, we... coordinate with other Lutheran denominations in other countries around world hunger issues, around disaster relief, and to some extent theological dialogue, but policy decisions are not made on an international level. That gives us a little bit more freedom to have some cultural differences than, say, the Anglican Church does.
Well, in fact, it's actually the local church that chooses pastors, correct?
Yes. The policy on who becomes a pastor and what that process is set nationally, but individual congregations have a large amount of latitude in which individual who has already been approved to be a pastor they would like to call as their pastor.
What brought you into the church in the first place?
I grew up in the Lutheran Church. And I grew up in a Lutheran church. My family, my mother is a lifelong Lutheran and my father is not. And so I knew that there were options. But at the same time, I grew up in the church and it was the place that formed an awful lot about me. And it was the place that taught me the things I believe and, in fact, taught me to do exactly the things that I'm doing. To say God loves all. Everybody, to say the center of our faith is about the good news that God does for us, not about the good things that we do, and to say occasionally the church is wrong and occasionally the church needs to be reminded of what its true calling is. I was taught that in Lutheran Sunday schools, and so I think the things that I'm doing, even disobeying church policy, are Lutheran at their very core.
Your training, is it different for GLBT people versus non-GLBT people?
No, I went to a Lutheran seminary, which the Lutheran Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. The faculty there was extraordinarily supportive of me. And my coursework was exactly the same as my straight colleagues or closeted colleagues. Mm-hmm. I was the only Lutheran candidate for ministry who was completely open. There were others who were various degrees of open, and at the seminary there were Episcopalians who were in training to be ministers who were completely out. There were Lutherans who were taking coursework for reasons other than training to be in ministry. So I certainly wasn't alone, but my path towards ministry has been the same as other folks, with the exception that my credentialing body is the Extraordinary Lutheran Ministries, not the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.
So what are your impressions of Houston as you just moved here?
You know, I had some preconceived notions about Texas before I came here, and I have
been... And some of them are probably still true.
Perhaps they are.
Yes.
I have a perhaps a skewed perception because I live in Montrose, I work in Montrose, and I've explored a little bit outside of Montrose, but not very much. I've only been here for a few weeks, but I have been delighted. I have loved the community that I have found here. you know, it's funny if you talk about energy deregulation. I would have thought it was a bad thing when I found out that I had 19 different electricity companies to choose from. I was floored, but then I discovered some of them are green energy, and I can choose to get the electricity sent to my house to be more sustainable than fossil fuels. Wow! So there I'm, and Montrose's thrift stores, Montrose's farmers markets, or the ones a little bit outside of Montrose, the community here, I'm beginning to touch a little bit on the activist community, and I'm delighted. I am very surprised to love living here.
Well, it is an interesting place. How about the heat?
It hasn't bothered me as much as I expected. And we're inside air conditioning all the time. So in Maryland, it's 5 degrees cooler and a heck of a lot less humid, but I was often not in air conditioning, so it doesn't bother me too much.
It's just longer here.
It's just longer.
Yes, now I'm one of those damn Yankees who love the heat.
You know, they had me interview in April. I think that was very tricky.
Yes.
When the church flew me
yes.
down to interview, it
yes.
was April. And
yes,
I'm
yes, April or October is the time. Where do you see the future of Grace Lutheran? And I know this is, you're a little bit early
right.
to ask this question.
Sure. Well, some of it we have to find out. I know I don't see Grace Lutheran ever being a mega church, but we're being very intentional about saying, what are the community's needs, both physical, emotional, spiritual? What are the ways that we can reach out, and what are the ways that we can build an inclusive community? I think the community that they have built, the way they care for each other, is already very impressive. But what are the ways that we can improve that? And what those concrete needs are, I don't know yet. I'm still getting to know this community, this neighborhood, and the congregation, because they've been without a pastor for the past 5 years, is
five years.
They're very excited to have me. They were very slow and very deliberate and very careful about who they were going to choose to call.
And I don't know how the church does the interviewing process, but the nonprofit interview process that goes around with some of these organizations, if people don't know it, just go on forever.
Absolutely. Yes.
And ever.
Yes. We exchanged our initial paperwork, was it December or January, and I just started July 1st. And, of course, I was not the only person that they were talking
sure,
to.
Sure, sure. The facility, it's right in the heart of Montrose.
Absolutely.
Are most of the people who go to the church live in Montrose, or are there people that come
No, there are people who live close by, but it's something of a magnet church, surprisingly enough, for 30 people. There are people who are very, very committed to being Lutheran, who were looking for a gay-friendly church, who traveled 30, 40 miles to come to Grace Lutheran. There are people who are not committed to being Lutheran, but somebody invited them, and this was the community they stumbled into and love. There are people who've been who've been members of this congregation for 50 years who just stay because they love it.
The GLBT group that's within the Lutheran church, what are
mm-hmm.
they called?
One group is called Lutherans Concerned. Another group is called Extraordinary Lutheran Ministries. They work closely together.
Okay. Do they find a particular church, or do they just worship with any Lutheran church within an area?
Sure. There's a way that a Lutheran congregation can kind of come out as being gay-friendly or mm-hmm. queer-friendly by going through a process to declare themselves publicly as being reconciling in Christ. So they have an intentional discussion within their congregation, they take a vote, and they say, we want to publicly state that people of all sexual orientations and gender identities are welcome at this congregation. And then once they do that, there's a website that is maintained by Lutherans Concerned of all the congregations that are reconciling in Christ. I can say that when I moved to a new city before I came to seminary, the first thing I would do would be to go and look at that list, because then it would tell me which congregations have already had this discussion, that I'm not going to be the first one there. And because sometimes on Sunday morning you look just looking for a safe place. And Grace Lutheran Church made that decision in 1995, which was fairly early for Lutheran churches.
What does the church do to outreach to the community?
At this point, a lot of things have fallen by the wayside in terms of their local community outreach. In the past, they housed Hatch, which is a ministry to LGBT homeless youth. That's something that they're less connected to right now. The organization needed to move to a different space for practical reasons. individual members of the community are very active in neighborhood groups, in community groups, but without a pastor, their more natural inclinations were to advocacy work on the national level, but they're asking me and begging me, please help us reconnect to the Montrose community. It's one of my primary jobs to do there.
How did the church run? How did Grace Lutheran run without a pastor?
They have some amazing, strong, beautiful, passionate lay leaders who are people who are really committed to this work and to keeping this church alive. And the congregation, because one of the groups of people it attracts are people who've been hurt by other churches. We have a surprising number of people who've been to seminary, who've been trained to be clergy in other denominations and left those denominations or those positions when they came out. So I have a few members of the congregation who are former clergy, and so they picked up the preaching and presiding over Eucharist, over communion, and some of the other tasks. Although some of the people doing that weren't seminary trained and did an amazing job. I'm not letting them drop the task completely. I'm right. Still saying that once a month I would love for them to preach. And so,
have you met some of your other peers with the Lutheran churches here in Houston?
I have met some of the other pastors who have been quietly welcoming, but I'm shaking things up a little bit, and I can tell that they're still trying to figure out what to make of me.
Interesting.
They're personally welcoming, but on a professional public level, they're kind of, what's going to happen when she comes? I don't know. We'll see. That's kind of the impression I've had.
So, as you came to Houston, there's probably some other places you looked at. Can you compare or contrast some of the other, and you don't have to name the cities, or mm-hmm. and it's really interesting, you talked about an urban church, and it's how most of the churches moved out, or, mm-hmm. you know, even like the YMCAs in many cities moved out to the suburbs,
right.
because that's where the money is.
Right, and white flight hurt urban congregations
sure.
immensely, and many of them are still learning how to recover the mainline denominations from that phenomena. I actually, believe it or not, congregations for openly queer pastors are few and far between. I didn't
really?
Have very many to interview at. The other interviews I was doing, other positions I was considering, were advocacy positions, mm-hmm. Where I would have been the professional queer person, which, although I'm out, I wanted there to be issues in my life. There are issues in my life that are important besides sexual orientation. There was another position I was considering that was to be a pastor to homeless folks on the street, walking the streets at night. Also a very attractive position to me. It was one that I considered very seriously. I've been a case manager to homeless folks in my life before. That's very dear to my heart. But at this point in my life, I really felt called to a congregation. How can an urban congregation reach out into the community? And so I'm delighted to have this.
Well, you know, it's a really interesting conversation, because here in Houston we have, as we talked about, the big mega church of
mm-hmm.
Lakewood,
right.
which is you know, national. It was on 60 mm-hmm. Minutes not long ago, and they just opened up the Cold Cathedral
mm-hmm.
here, which
right.
they spent $40 million on.
Mm-hmm.
And strangely enough, it's located downtown in Houston.
Yeah.
And here you are working on a very small church, but you've got such a positive outlook and wanting to work within the community.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a group of religious sort of organizations, you know, outside just the Lutheran Church, that sort of try to work together or dialogue?
You know,
or is it informal?
I'm probably the wrong person to ask,
okay.
since I just came to town. If any of your listeners know of one, please contact me. I have been very informally welcomed by an informal network of clergy who identify as progressive, part of the progressive community. They somehow found out through clergy grapevines that I was coming, and that ecumenical group has welcomed me with very warm arms. I don't even know if it's formalized enough to have a name. So, but like I said, I'm brand new to Houston. It could exist in ways that I don't know about, and in which case I would love to be plugged in.
Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you'd like to bring up? Let's talk about when the services are at the church.
Yes, absolutely. Services at this point, Sunday morning at 10:30. with Sunday school starting at 9. 10:30 is our service. We also have a midweek service on Wednesday at 7. I would absolutely invite anyone who's interested
7 a.m. or 7 p.m.?
7 p.m. Thank you very much. I would absolutely invite anybody who's interested in finding out how one can be queer and Christian, how that works, or is just interested in what an open community is interested in anti-racism work, environmentalism, anti-consumerism, to come see how that relates to faith.
And where exactly is the church located?
2515 Waugh Drive.
What's a cross street?
That is right above Westheimer.
I think it's about two blocks north of Westheimer.
Yeah.
I know it's above California, which is the first block there.
Yeah.
Corner, yes. And what about, of course,
Missouri.
The question you always have to ask in an urban area is, what about parking?
We do have parking lot. Parking is absolutely available. There is, if you turn on Missouri from Waugh, you will see one parking lot on your right, which is ours, and one on your left immediately past the church. So that is absolutely available.
And how can people contact you?
I would love it if people would check out our website, www.gracelutheran-houston.org. They may email me at LURA.GROEN@gmail.com or call the church at 713-528-3269.
I have a question.
Yes.
In your church services,
yes.
What is the normal sort of mode of dress? Is it very casual dress?
You know, anyone can come in any way they want. We have a diverse economic group. We have homeless folks coming in blue jeans. We have professional folks coming in blue jeans. And we have people who wear some fancy church hats and everything in between.
And they may not all be women. Huh?
They may not all be women.
Okay. Well, it's wonderful. I hope you'll come back and talk to us after
Thank you very much.
Sort of get your feet on the ground.
Absolutely.
And tell us about some of the things that you've learned and stumbling blocks and stuff like that, because we all do that. And welcome to Houston.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, absolutely. Give us your name again.
My name is Pastor Lura Gruen of Grace Evangelical Lutheran Church in Montrose.
Thank you very much. You're listening to Queer Voices.
No.
I Dig Balola from her new CD, Gay Without Shame. That was I Ain't Ashamed.
This is Queer Voices.
Coming up later in the program, we'll hear about one woman who uncovered the true nature of little-known cultures, and we'll hear from another woman who uncovers false assumptions about contemporary families. But first... Her celebration of Italian-American and lesbian identity, Looking for Cover, poems by Maria Fama, includes a new look at an old favorite, Sappho. Fama explores the Sicilian roots of the poetess in exile. This Way Out correspondent Janet Mason explores The Explorer.
To read Maria Fama's poetry is to enter another world that is wrought in lush and sensuous detail. You will find a rich history filled with the common folk, the peasants, who have come to this country from Italy, where they struggled and dreamed, and in passing down the stories of their lives and hardship, they have made the writer, and by extension the reader, stronger and more appreciative of life's simple pleasures. Her most recent collection of poetry, Looking for Covers, poems by Maria Fama, published by Bordighera Press in New York, is a study in identity. Fama writes, as an Italian-American connected and adventuring into her heritage, as a woman identifying the strengths, often overlooked but inherent, in the conventions and confinement of the lives of previous generations of women, and as a lesbian identifying with the unspoken passions of the past, and also conveying the passions of her own life. Fama writes from these identities and of these identities from the subterranean fields of richly textured experience and not from labels. In some respects, the writing is ahead of its time, but also it is of its time and timeless. In this collection, we meet the Camari, the Italian word for a special bond between women that went beyond friends. One of these Camari, defined by Fama's wordplay as co-Marys and co-Marias, is Fama's aunt, Zia Angelina. Angelina and her special friend, her Camari, live two doors away from each other. Camare Angelina, Camare Maria, late afternoons they sipped. They sipped and dipped, they sipped espresso, they dipped biscotti. In the late afternoon they sipped and dipped before the suppers and the husbands filled their homes. The two Camari mark their birthdays together, their name days, and Angelina searches the stores of South Philadelphia for the card that contains the sentiment that she has for her Camari. She searched high and low and was unable to find anything, so she bought a To My Husband card. She took the card home and with a black pen crossed out the word husband and wrote Camari. To my dear Camari. The words all fit. They fit, she knew they fit. She knew they fit her. Camare, Camare, Camare Maria. Angelina's Camare Maria. The poem, Camari, is from the section of the book called Under the Tent, Performance Poems, some of which are recorded in Maria's voice on a companion CD. This section also contains Fama's piece entitled simply Sappho. In this exploration of the great lesbian poetess, whose Greek name is invoked, Sappho, Fama sees her Italian grandmother's face on the face of a young, beautiful Greek woman dancing at the festival. She takes this experience and launches it into a journey of her connection. As a woman who loves women and as a woman whose line of descent can be traced back to Sicily, the place where the poetess Sappho once lived in exile, she writes of the connection between Greece and Italy, between her own history and Sappho's, and the Sicilian and Greek saying, one face, one race, in Italian, una faccia, una razza. Greek and Sicilian, Tyrrhenian, Ionian, Aegean seas, the deepest blue, black eyes and green seas, sapphire, sapphic seas. This collection is peopled with the living and the dead, the loved ones and ancestors that she keeps alive in her memories, writing, and conversations with friends. From the Camari to the Sicilian understanding of Sappho, to the ancestors and loved ones who have passed, Fama invokes her culture in richly textured writing full of sensuous details, allowing us as readers to enter this subterranean world where everything is honored. And in experiencing and understanding this, we learn to honor ourselves just a little bit more. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer literature and life for This Way Out.
Margaret Mead, prominent American anthropologist, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Margaret Mead was born in Philadelphia in 1901. Entering adulthood, she felt urged to advance the understanding of human behavior. Studying anthropology at Barnard College, she met her mentor, Ruth Benedict. Their relationship would become the most intimate of Mead's life, lasting throughout her three marriages. Mead's field study in the South Pacific led to her bestseller, Coming of Age in Samoa. Her research of various cultures made her one of the first in the modern age to champion diversity. In a 1975 article for Red Book magazine, she asserted it was time to recognize bisexuality as a normal form of sexual expression. She feared that revealing her own bisexuality would close doors in her career. But she said everyone should be able to choose companionship with a member of their own or opposite sex, which certainly opened doors for the next generation. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Candace Kimbrick.
Hi, this is Janice Ian, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. Support your local public radio station. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
The law has changed so that we have gender equality in marriage under the law, and I think that makes a lot of people think that the problems have been solved when, of course, they haven't been.
Last time on This Way Out, law professor Nancy Polakoff explained why she believes marriage equality is not the be-all and end-all of family rights. In this week's conclusion, correspondents Josie Catoggio and Melissa Chiprin ask the author of Beyond Straight and Gay Marriage, Valuing All Families Under the Law, about one particular case that crystallized the issue.
I wanted to talk about Sharon Kowalski.
I start the book with her because certainly all of us who lived through that remember it very clearly. So Sharon Kowalski was very severely injured in a car accident. She had a partner of 4 years, Karen Thompson. They were not out to Sharon's family. Really, they weren't out to very many people. And Karen arrives at the hospital, isn't allowed to see Sharon. That's the beginning of 10 years of struggle over who's going to control Sharon's welfare. And for most of that time, Sharon's father was her guardian. Karen, at one point, it was 3.5 years that Karen couldn't even visit Sharon or see her. It was a complete tragedy and disgrace. Sharon's care deteriorated greatly.
I mean, her parents put her in a place where she was not getting rehabilitative
exactly.
care, even though she had indicated that she wanted her partner to be her
well,
caretaker.
And that's why disability rights groups were also very involved in this case, because Sharon did have some ability to express what she wanted, and a series of judges just continually disregarded that on the theory that it wasn't reliable because of her disability. So there was quite a lot of political effort, but meanwhile she did deteriorate. Now ultimately Karen did become her guardian. Karen was in a new relationship at that time, but she and her new partner brought Sharon back to their home, which Karen had completely fitted for Sharon's wheelchair, and the three of them continued to live together. Today, a family constellation that I think really challenges a lot of people's ideas about what a family is. That's why I argue so much that the law shouldn't be making these arbitrary limits. I mean, those three people do form a family together. And in order to keep those kinds of problems from happening, and I would also say I'm quite sympathetic to the same-sex couples who say they want to marry because they're terrified of what will happen if one of them's hospitalized.
My lover and I just had papers drawn up. I mean, that's what one does. You know, you do medical and legal powers of attorney.
Yes, you do that. But, you know, there are even examples of hospitals that have not honored those. And the answer is not marriage. I mean, that is so the wrong answer. First of all, one of the things I most surprised people with in the book is a study in Detroit of older married couples that showed that 50% of them didn't pick their spouses to be their medical power of attorney, so when they made them. So, you know, not everybody wants a spouse to do it. We need to make sure we have a way of facilitating what you and your partner did without having to go to lawyers. And there are actually states that do that very easily now. And I use Idaho as an example. There are some others. But, you know, people I know in Idaho who've gone to their primary care doctors, they actually get a little pamphlet saying, you know, fill out these forms, send them in to the Secretary of State's office. It goes into a database. You get a wallet card to carry with your driver's license. And if you ever are hospitalized, they look at this card. They type numbers into the computer at the hospital, and they get the document right there on the screen. And there can't be any questions about who it is who's entitled to make medical decisions. I'm hopeful that if enough states do this, we could get a national registry for these advanced health care directives, and it could become as easy as organ donation, or maybe even easier than organ donation, as a routine matter with no charge whatsoever for everybody to make clear who they want to make these decisions for them. Because you may have a partner, and the two of you may do this, but what about our single friends? They don't have a partner to do it with jointly, and certainly, of course, marriage is not anywhere near what's going to help them, but they should be equally entitled to make sure that their wishes about who makes decisions for them are recognized. So this is a very bad fit, the argument that we need to have marriage in order for same-sex couples to be able to have these medical protections. And so I do describe in the book the other ways to do it and the states that get it right. And really how silly the argument is, because unless those couples, even if they can marry, even if they're in Massachusetts, if they're never going to leave the state of Massachusetts, maybe they'll be okay. But if they travel outside the state, we've got more than half the states in this country that have constitutional amendments that ban same-sex marriage. I want everybody in those states to make sure the person they want makes their health care decisions. And I think we can accomplish this, because if you take it out of the context of same-sex marriage, there's really universal agreement that you and I and everybody else should get to pick the person who makes those decisions. And we can bypass the politics of same-sex marriage and get this problem solved for everybody.
Nancy, this is Melissa. I wanted to go back to something you said earlier. Is there a time frame when you say, like, a couple would get the legal rights that say that a married couple have?
Well, in Canada, they actually do, for most things, have a time frame. Some of them involve living together for a year, and others involve living together for 3 years. And some of their court cases show that living together is a little bit loose, like you could actually have two homes and still be living together under some factual circumstances. So there is a time frame for some of these rights to kick in. But if you think about it, perhaps some of those rights, even for people who marry, where you have marriage, should take a while to kick in. New Zealand actually has a law where if they don't have children, when they're married for less than 3 years, when they get divorced, each person just takes their own stuff and goes away. Like, they don't have the whole regime of property division in marriage until after they've been married for 3 years. So, you know, that's a good example of how instantly when you marry, nothing's really changed in your life except that piece of paper. And instantly you're entitled to inherit, for example, from the other person. And one of the things I talk about in the book is that you can't disinherit your spouse, but you can disinherit your children. Like, how shocking is that? That if you've got some children with a former spouse, you can leave them absolutely nothing in your will, period. But your new spouse, that person you can't disinherit. I mean, it's completely backwards. Anyway, for some of the things that I talk about in the book, I think a durational requirement makes a certain amount of sense. But for other things, you know, you're just really looking at how the people function together. And duration may not have anything to do with that. Washington State right now will divide the property of a couple that lives together, married or unmarried, in the same exact way. And so they don't use a durational time, but, you know, if you're only married for a year, there's not going to be much community property to divide. And if you're only living together for a year, the same thing. There's not going to be much community property to divide. But Washington State is the one place in this country now where if you live your life as an intimate family unit and you separate, they don't care whether you got married or not.
We've been talking with Nancy Polakoff about her book, Beyond Straight and Gay Marriage, Valuing All Families Under the Law, published by Beacon Press. Thank you so much, Nancy.
Thanks so much. It's been great talking to you.
And our thanks to This Way Out correspondents Josie Cotoggio and Melissa Chiprin. Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Lee Moore, John Beaupre, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Janet Mason, Judd Proctor, and Brian Burns with Candace Gingrich, and Josie Cotoggio and Martha Chiprin contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to help keep us on the air. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of all our programs there. To receive weekly email alerts describing the content of each This Way Out, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KSOW Cottage Grove, Oregon, 2HOT Cobar, New South Wales, WOJB Hayward, Wisconsin, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. We're all going to stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
So, Jack, any final notes, closing comments?
The House approved the HIV lifting of the ban for people coming into this country who are HIV. And according to the Washington Post, most of the usual Republicans in the area voted against it, and most of the usual Democrats voted for it. And basically, there's only about six countries around the world that had the same ban on people coming to their country who were HIV.
So is that done now, or does it still need to go to a president for signature?
It is, because I believe both sides of the votes are veto-proof, both from the House and the Senate. And we want to thank everybody for listening tonight. We'll be back again next week starting at 9 p.m. Our new time. And if you'd like a copy of the show, go to iTunes and you can download it probably within a day.
Oh, very good. And you can also download it from kpft.org. Listen to it that way too. And then also remember that KPFT has programming on HD. We have, I guess the regular stream is on HD1, and then they have an alternate stream on HD2.
Which is mostly the BBC World Services, but there are also some other good programs on HD2.
You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
This August, KPFT is hosting its summer fundraising campaign, but this drive will not be like any other drive you've heard. I'm Dwayne Bradley, KPFT General Manager, here to tell you that during the various days of the summer sizzle, KPFT will reduce the amount of time we're asking for your support. Does it sound like the manager's gone crazy? Not yet. This is an experiment. We depend on your financial support to keep KPFT strong, and we know we can serve you better if we don't interrupt our entire schedule with constant fundraising pleas. You come to KPFT for great music, news, and views. That's what we want to provide. Help us build up a reserve now with your online pledge at kpft.org. You can also call the station at 713-526-4000, extension 314, to make that pledge early. KPFT Houston is doing this coming pledge drive a little bit differently, and your support today helps us get back to the programs you love. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
KPFT's Prison Show presents the Prison Reform Film Festival 2008, August 15th through 17th at Rice Cinema. Using the theme, Rock the Lockup, this series brings you a variety of individuals and stories on the criminal justice system, including the documentary on KPFT's own Ray Hill. For a complete schedule of events, film descriptions, and more information, visit kpft.org and tune in to The Prison Show Fridays at 9 p.m. Again, the Prison Reform Film Festival 2008 happens August 15th through 17th at Rice Cinema on the campus of Rice University. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.